This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm in the Aera Pilot House in Nome, Alaska, sitting down with three of the Aera pilots. Actually, one is not an Aera pilot anymore. He's moved on to a different job. But we've got John, Sean, and Matt here. Matt's a mechanic or engineer. What we're going to focus on with this discussion is John's recent career flying in Africa. He's just recently returned to Alaska after 5 years in Africa. And a little brief bit of John's background, he flew in Alaska for a lot of years and had experience in numerous aircraft. And at some point he decided he wanted to go to Africa. So let's kind of dig into that. So John, when you'd flown here for probably 10 years or more?
Yeah, it was about 10 years.
And then you decided to go to, I mean, you said you were interested in Africa previously and just decided to go.
Well, really, Aiden, what happened was, you know, when you work in Alaska, you find yourself working quite a bit. And I decided after about 10 years of never taking a real vacation that I was going to do just that. So for the first time in about 10 years, I took a 5-week vacation. And during that time, I realized there's a whole lot of world out there outside of Alaska. And so when I returned after that vacation, I immediately started looking for new work. And I'm primarily a bush pilot. I've never really been interested in flying for the airlines. And Africa, there were some jobs available, and I saw them on a website, and I sent my resume to them, and that's how it all got started.
Cool. So you got hired via the internet?
Yes.
In your years there, have you found that's a pretty standard way to get a job over there if you're coming from the outside?
Well, once I got over there, I realized that it's just like anywhere else. You make contacts with people, and they refer you to the chief pilot. But because I'd never been over there, my only source of introduction was, you know, the job sites that I went on to. And when I sent the resume, they were in desperate need, because within moments, I got a reply with an offer to come over and work.
That's cool. And it certainly helped that you'd been in Alaska and you had a lot of experience.
Yeah.
Did they know about Alaska in particular? Did that factor in, or is it just that you had a lot of flight time?
I think they probably did, because I think Alaska internationally is known as a place that has some unique challenges when it comes to flying and the type of pilot that you turn into when you work here.
Okay.
And Africa is most definitely a very bush style of flying environment. So I think it would just be a good choice that if they were going to try and find a pilot that could make it in bush Africa.
Alaskan pilots are a good pool for them to draw from.
Right.
Yeah. So you were, I mean, Africa's huge. I mean, it's an enormous continent, and you were in two countries primarily when you got over there.
I was initially based in Brazzaville, Congo.
Okay.
And then I moved over to Democratic Republic of Congo. And then eventually, after working there for about a year, I moved up to Algeria.
Okay. And you found conditions are similar from country to country? Or is it, I mean, if you change countries, you get drastically different conditions?
Well, I was working for, I was primarily doing humanitarian aid.
Okay.
And the company I worked for had contracts with these aid organizations. And a part of the arrangement was that the pilot housing had to meet a certain level, both in quality of life, but also, and most importantly, security. So I was really fortunate to be housed in places that were quite nice.
Okay, and this is, yeah, if you're living, these are countries that aren't particularly stable. If you're in the Congo and the Democratic Republic of Congo and Algeria, which I don't think either are currently officially at war with anyone.
Well, the Congo is what they would call a conflict zone.
Right.
And the pilot housing was always located in what they called the green zone, where it had been surveyed to make sure that there was the least amount of hazard or danger to
in that area.
Now there were little, I guess you could say, conflicts occurring all the time, but not where I was living.
Okay. That's what I've seen that too. Everybody thinks of a whole country. They're like, well, that country's just at war. It's not safe anywhere. And it's always like, well, it's not safe here. It's not safe here. But there are huge sections of the country where it is safe and business continues. Life continues on.
That's right.
Okay, so you were probably, was it armed compounds? I mean, it's armed guards or just guards?
The guards did not have weapons.
Okay.
But there were a lot of weapons at the airport.
Okay, that'll cover that. And you're flying a Let 410.
Yes, I was.
Now, we're kind of back to the flying a little bit. I want to talk about the Let. Is it, when I've been through Africa, you see a lot of Lets all over the country. It's very prevalent. You don't see them in the U.S. at all. Do you like it?
Well, the Let's a great aircraft. It was designed to be used by the Russian military.
Okay.
and the Russian civilian transport.
It's a Czech plane.
It's built in the Czech Republic. It was always built. Now the Czech Republic became the Czech Republic in the 90s. It was formerly Czechoslovakia,
right.
And the airplane actually is certified by the FAA.
Huh.
It just, for various reasons, just never made it over this way.
Huh.
And the design of the systems in the airplane are to be a very cold weather operating aircraft. So if we were to have had the Let here in Alaska, it would have done fantastic.
Huh, they're all over Africa where it's not that cold.
Right.
And the Let, just for people who know, it's a twin turbine, non-pressurized, high-wing, retractable gear plane.
Right.
Similar to a Dash 8.
Yeah, it's a 19-passenger.
Looks cooler.
Yeah, it's a 19-passenger. It's a high-wing, and it has stall capability. It can land and take off in very short fields.
Which is appropriate, because you're landing at high altitude. They may not be the shortest strips in the world, but they're high altitude, and they're not long.
Right, and it's also high density altitude. It's very hot over there.
Yep. So you're flying, this first time you've flown the Let, compared to the other planes you flew, it was an easy plane to get into and figure out.
It was. It was very stable. It's the speeds of the airplane are similar to the Navajo.
Okay, which you'd flown a lot.
Right. And so it was, and as far as all the characteristics of flying, it was not an airplane that you could easily get behind. It was, you could, at least for me, I had an easy time adapting to it. And I think any pilot that has any light twin experience would find the same thing.
Would figure it out quickly. That's cool. But of course, your top speed was faster than Navajo. Cruise speed.
Actually, no.
Really?
We flight planned for 165 knots.
Really? That's
it? Yeah.
I always thought it was more like MU2 speeds.
No.
But not even close then.
It just looks like an MU2.
It just looks fast.
Yeah.
It is cool. It reminds the Dornier 228 that we've talked about a little bit. It sort of has similar characteristics, it seems like.
Right.
So it's a good plane. It's a good plane in Africa.
Sure.
So, I mean, they're all over the place. It must be. Except for that goofy door that opens backwards.
Yeah, but they figured that out. And so the newer models, it opens like a normal door.
And doesn't go right into the propeller.
Right.
Yeah, so for you folks, the door opens backwards, which prevents the pilot from walking into the door. But if the door opens accidentally in flight, it goes right into the prop. But they fixed it.
Yes.
So cool. So you started off in Brazzaville, and you were there for a long time? Or
I was there about a year.
Okay, so that was your big introduction to Brazzaville, or to Africa with Brazzaville.
Yes.
And you'd been there on vacation before.
Well, I hadn't been to Brazzaville. I prior to taking the job in Africa, I just took a trip that took me to some different countries.
Okay.
And then when Africa came into my sights, mainly because that's where jobs were available.
Right.
Outside of the U.S.
Yep. When you first got to Brazzaville, what was your, thought? Coming from Bush, Alaska, where life's kind of rustic here as well, were there any big surprises to Brazzaville?
The living in Brazzaville was I would have to say, a lot like living in Alaska, with the exception of the fact that it was always about 90 degrees, and there was a heck of a lot more people.
Oh, yeah, a lot more people, and you don't load and unload your plane too much.
Oh, yeah, well, when the flying, come to the flying duties, it was great, because all I did was show up in my pressed white shirt with my epaulets and watch people do all the hard work that I'd used to have been doing myself.
Fantastic, and your flights that you were doing out of Brazenville, then how did they, how long were they? Were they international? Did you go to different countries, or was it?
Well, we would go, we would leave Brazzaville and take a 15-minute flight across the Congo River over to the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo, of Kinshasa. We would then load passengers and cargo for humanitarian aid, and we would take a route up the Congo River and end our day in Bangui, the capital city of Central African Republic.
Okay, and then you fly home.
And then we would spend the night there.
Okay.
And then fly back the same route the next day.
Okay, and that doesn't sound like a real long flight to me.
Well, it was about 2 hours from, the first leg was 15 minutes over to Kinshasa.
Okay.
And then it was about 2 hours from Kinshasa up to Bandaka.
Oh, okay.
And then another hour from Bandaka up to Bangui.
Okay, so you got 3-4 hours.
Yeah.
That's not
bad. We would leave at 7 a.m. out of Brazza, and we would be at the hotel poolside by 12 o'clock.
Poolside, nice.
Poolside, yeah.
Just like Alaska.
Yeah, just like.
Yeah, and something another difference between Alaska and Alaska, I've always found, they're the quickest turns on any one stop. Now, when you get back to Nome or your main base, it might not be quick, but when you're at the villages, sometimes you're on the ground for a minute. And everywhere else I've gone, it's just a more drawn-out process. I don't know if you saw, you know, you land, usually there are people you talk to, there's a fueler who shows up. It's like a little mini-event.
Yeah, what I had to really allow the system to work.
Right.
Because if I got too involved in trying to make everything happen, then I would step on people's toes.
Right.
Because there was someone that would take care of the fuel, someone would take care of the landing fee, the filing of the flight plan, the organizing of all the cargo and the passengers, and so it was quite an event.
And people doing those jobs is here. The pilot kind of does everything. But there are people take their job, it's a job, so they take it seriously. They don't want you doing their job. So it always just struck me that it's just better, this is for anyone who comes from Alaska, goes to Africa, just stand back and watch things happen. I mean, supervise, nobody does anything stupid, but you're the pilot, and other people take care of the other parts of the flight.
That's right. That's very well said, and it took me a few months to learn that lesson the hard way, that it's best to just let everyone do what they know how to do, regardless of how well they do it.
Right.
Because once you start stepping in on someone else's responsibilities, that's where tensions start flying.
Right. Did you find any, did everybody get along pretty well? I mean, was it, when you're working with people, were there tensions between different nationalities or...
Well, in the Congo, the organizations that I worked for, they hired people from mostly Africa.
Okay.
And they were all operating on the same playbook, so to speak. Now, I'm sure there were differences, but you know, they all did a pretty good job of maintaining professionalism and not having too many issues surface out on the ramp.
Okay.
So it worked
pretty
out
smooth.
Pretty good. Yeah, it was good.
So different nationalities, pilots as well, not just Americans, obviously.
I was actually the only American that worked where I was at.
Okay, they getting that? I know the DRC and the Congo and the CRA, they don't have flight schools, so their pilots are coming from other countries in Africa.
Right. Well, the company I worked for was actually based out of South Africa.
Okay.
So a lot of the pilots were South African, and then there was also some South American pilots and some European pilots.
Okay. They didn't seem to be a preference for hiring, well, South Africans, I'm sure, but they're a South African company.
Right.
But South Americans, Europeans are fine. Converting licenses?
Well, I was on a, my license was a validated license because the aircraft was registered in South Africa. So it was required that I have a South African validation.
Okay, and they send you to South Africa for that?
They did, yeah. And actually, because I was an FAA pilot, the FAA recognizes the LET as an aircraft, but there's nobody in the United States that can actually administer a check ride on the aircraft. So therefore, a type rating cannot appear on your license. So I actually, to become a pilot for this company, I had to go through the certification process in the country of Ghana. So I actually possess a Ghana ATP. And I then took that license and had it validated by South Africa.
Okay, so they validate your Ghanaian license and you've got a type rating in the LET from Ghana.
Yes.
So if you ever came up with a job in the U.S. flying a LET, you'd have to get another type rating. And they'd have to find someone who could give it to you.
That's right.
Okay. But that wasn't a hurdle when you were getting the job? I mean, they just understood whoever they hired, they were going to have to...
They laid out that procedure when they first responded. They said, because you're an FAA pilot, we are going to have to send you to Ghana to get certified.
Okay, and they didn't blink an eye at it?
No.
Is that... I mean, I know you probably don't have a 100% answer to this, but looking at the other companies that you were working around... Did they sort of do the same? It seemed like a similar process other companies were using, or was that unique?
Well, a lot of the LET is actually one of the most popular twin turboprops for the commuter category ever built. And there's a lot of countries with a lot of different pilots that are certified to fly it. So because I came from the U.S., I was actually a very difficult pilot to hire I had to go do this Ghana procedure.
Right.
And I was the only one that had to do that. All the other pilots, the JAR countries recognize the aircraft.
Okay.
And then the other countries around the world where these pilots came from, they had that rating on their license.
Okay, so that was, we actually, you know, we're getting questions from people in Europe, UK quite a bit, and from Africa. So it would be, it's such a prevalent plane over there that if people were going to spend money to get a type or try to get a type some way through a company, the LET would be a great one to get some training in, some time in.
Right. South Africa has several carriers that do contract work in all of the continent of Africa. And so because they're South African registered, Zulu Sierra, you will either have to have a validated foreign license or have an actual South African ATP.
Okay.
Now, the South African CAA will allow you to convert your foreign ATP through a process of writing some written tests and then doing a practical exam, and then you'll actually be issued a South African license.
Okay, so I'm going to take this just a step further and probably a step too far. If I'm in Europe or the U.S. or Australia, some another country, and I'm really serious about flying in Africa, do you think is it necessary or would it be, I'm sure it would be useful, but is it really worth spending the time and money to go to South Africa, convert your licenses before you look for a job? Or they worked with you, do you think?
They're desperate, you were saying.
Yeah. I think, and I've advised some friends of mine of this, what I would do if I was to do it all over again, or just if someone were to ask me what's the best way about getting a job in South Africa, is let it be known that you are willing to go through the conversion process.
Okay.
And actually, all the study material would be supplied by the company.
Okay.
They would be required. Any pilot that wishes to do this would have to study up on meteorology, flight planning and performance, and then the air law.
Okay.
And after successfully completing those three exams, then there's a practical test that doesn't matter what country you're in. You can either fly it or you can't.
Right. Yep.
And then you would then have a South African ATP. Now the reason that it's a whole lot better for a guy to go about it that way is that if he comes from a country that, like I did, that doesn't have a lead on his license, when you validate a license, all the validation process does is allows you to use your license in that country. And an examiner working for a company, such as the one I work for, cannot give you a check ride and then put a type rating onto your validated license. But however, they can if you possess a South African license.
Okay. So if you really are serious about flying, you could go get a validated license. If you're there 6 months, that's probably worth doing, just get a validation. But if you're really going to make a career flying in Africa, the South African license is probably the one that's going to do you the most good.
Yes.
Okay, that's good to know.
This is Sean, and a question that I have is that is South Africa the prevalent nation of African aviation?
Yes, okay. Definitely.
Yeah, and I've seen that. They've got a pretty strong general aviation. They have flight schools.
So if somebody wanted to go to Africa and fly over there, then South Africa would definitely be the one to deal with.
Yeah,
but you correct me if I'm wrong, and this Aiden again, if you want to get a flying job, South Africa is probably not the place to get the job because they have a lot of South African pilots.
Well, they have a lot of pilots, but the work that I was doing is what is termed as contract work.
Right, and this is actually, I was going to ask this later, because you're doing humanitarian aid flying for various organizations that do it, and we get questions about this. And what I've found is that most of the humanitarian aid work, which is the UN or I work for AirServe, but a lot of it's contracted work. In other words, you don't get a job that you're only going to fly humanitarian aid. You work for a company that has a contract, and they might put you on a different contract as well.
That's right. That's exactly what I was doing.
Okay. So you just worked for a company. They had this contract. You were put on that contract, but they could have pulled you back, said, hey, John, we need you to fly this scheduled flight with passengers from Lanseria to Wilson Nairobi Airport.
They could have, yeah.
And you'd be like, okay.
Sure. Exactly.
But it didn't. You were doing all humanitarian aid.
Right. But to answer the question about South Africa actually would be the place that a pilot would go down to seek work. Because all the carriers that are doing contract work throughout the entire continent are primarily based in South Africa.
Mm. Got it. So you would go there to find the... So you may not, you're going there to find work not flying actually in South Africa, but it's going to be for a South African company that contracts.
That's right.
Gabon or wherever. Okay, that's good to know.
And South African carriers have a reputation of following through with what they say they're going to do.
Right.
All of the bad stories that you would hear about flying in Africa, those stories are primarily about companies that are not based in South Africa.
Right, a little more, not seat of the pants, but, I mean, you see them in Alaska, too, honestly. It's
fly-by-night.
Fly-by-night, that's the word I was looking for.
Right.
Yeah, and maintenance is going to be shifty. I saw that some of the South Africans tend to have good maintenance. It's a...
Western standards.
It's kind of a West, yeah.
Sure. South Africa is a developed nation.
Right.
They've been around for a long time, and they take pride in what they do.
Right.
And all of the aid organizations, oil companies, any company that you would find yourself working for, they know this.
Yeah. They have a.
And that's why you see the South African carriers doing what they do.
Right. Now you mentioned I'm going to back up a little bit back to your co-pilots. Because earlier when we were talking, you mentioned that your co-pilots were all young, pretty low time, usually pretty sharp. And they were coming out of South Africa or Europe for the most part.
For the most part, they were South African. I had a few Europeans, and most of them had... they were just starting in their careers.
Okay.
And they had just been through all of the rigid training and making sure that they could pass their check rides. And so if I ever had a question about the airplane, the very first thing I'd do is say, do you know the answer? And usually they did.
And then you're like, you know, you're right.
And then if we found one that they didn't, then we went ahead and pulled the book out and figured it out.
And you're like, I know, that's the one question I didn't know either. Right. And yeah, you said by and large they were pretty good. Now, you had some European co-pilots too, or is it?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I had my very first co-pilot was from the UK.
Okay.
And then I had a Hungarian.
That's what, one of my impressions of Africa is that Europeans view Africa like Americans in the lower 48 view Alaska. Like if you're low time, you're trying to get going in a career, Africa's a good place to go to get started.
Sure, sure. But the type of flying that I was doing was not necessarily time-building flying.
Right.
It's a career there.
Right, you can make a career of it.
Sure. Yeah.
When you're flying a LET, I mean, it's a real airplane. Not that a Super Cub's not real.
Right.
But, and you're doing, I mean, it was like airline flying. I mean, to a large degree, it was a schedule, you know, a set pattern. It was a good living.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
This is Matt. Can I add a question here?
Yeah.
I want to come from the perspective of a married person. I'm getting engaged. I'm engaged and I'm getting married this summer. And my fiance and I are interested in doing humanitarian overseas work in an aviation field. So these humanitarian organizations that you worked with, or ones that you saw working over there, were there much of opportunities for the spouse to work with these organizations or live in the same town or be based where you were at?
Yes, there was. In fact, they encourage it because there are jobs within the aid organizations that have office work. So whatever function you serve over there, either as a pilot or a mechanic, you would be out working your line job, and then your wife would be, you know, helping in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And something that's worth mentioning about this contract work is there's not very much work out there that allows you to be on duty for, say, a month at a time, and then be given a month time off.
Right.
And that's how these companies operate.
Usually.
So you're doing rotational work.
Right.
And you said you worked a lot of extra, but by and large, it was like a month on, month off type
about
schedule.
About that, yeah.
Now, for the spouse, are they working for NGOs, or are they working for the company, the airline?
Both.
Okay.
Both. But a lot of the NGOs offer employment opportunities for both.
And these are paid opportunities?
Sure, yeah.
Why I've not? Heard of a lot of humanitarian organizations that is volunteer, and so there isn't a whole lot of opportunity for income that way, but...
I think if you got there, you'd find, I'm sorry to jump in there a little bit, but I've looked into that too, and when you're here in the U.S., they're looking for volunteers. When you're there, they need paid positions too.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's easier to, you might do a volunteer work for a month, but something will come open.
Uh-huh.
Would be my guess.
Right. I know personally of some people that were living and working together, both getting paid.
Uh-huh. And so you're pretty much... You can kind of guarantee that you're going to be set in one spot as far as you're not going to move you to a base in a different part of the country without some kind of warning or...
Yeah, I mean, things always change, but they usually... To answer your question, you would be based in one place.
Right.
And then given plenty of opportunity to be advised that things were changing.
Right.
Well, this is going back to your idea of the co-pilots are coming down with low time, viewing it as a building time, but they're also viewing it, this might be my career. They're not always saying, I want to go fly for British Airways. And they're like, I might be here. So the company treats you as someone who might stick around.
That's right.
You're not always, I could be wrong on that, but companies want you to stick around, sort of.
Yeah, they do. They okay, do want cool. you to stay around. But what happens a lot of times is a pilot will get hired with the company, and the original motive is to gain time to be able to go somewhere else.
Right.
And then you start becoming comfortable with the salary that you're earning.
Yep.
And the time off that you're afforded, and people stick with it.
But just like here in Alaska.
Exactly.
Come up and say, I'm going to United Airlines, and pretty soon it's like, man, it's two on, two off with, you know, making 90 grand a year. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
First year at the airlines, I make 30.
Yeah.
So similar type of thing. Probably imagine the co-pilots don't make quite as much money, but they kind of look at it. I'm here, once I'm a captain, I've got a pretty good living in front of me.
Right, and the system's the same over there as it is here.
Yeah.
And this, Matt, again, it must have a different kind of feel, like when you're working for a greater cause versus just working for your own income, you're actually accomplishing something for the
There is a lot of that.
And I tell up with AirServe to some degree. You also have to keep in mind you're working for a company that may not have you on the humanitarian aid side all the time.
Uh-huh.
So you might be on that contract for a year, but then they might say, hey, listen, we need you on the standard air taxi type airline run.
Right.
And that's the company's there to make money, the company you're working for. Now, your contract you're on is with, you know, like humanitarian aid group, and that does feel pretty good working for, you know, they're there for the common good of humanity.
Uh-huh.
But there was a degree of a feeling of satisfaction that you'd done something, that you made a difference.
Uh-huh.
But then there was also, you could apply that to just about any flight you do.
Uh-huh.
But there was also times where you heavily relied on the, I'm making a difference. I am making a difference.
Actually, looking at that, I mean, we've kind of all talked about it being great. What were the hard times? Because I know even Alaska, which I by and large like, but you know, when you fly up here a lot, you don't always like it. I mean, I don't care how good the company is. There are times where you're just like, what the hell?
Right.
I just want to get out of here.
I could say all in all, the hard times that occurred over in Africa were equal to the hard times that happened here. If you don't have a good balance of work and relaxation, then it doesn't matter what country you're in. Flying too much is not fun.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there were some different challenges. Here we have the luxury of dealing with air traffic control that knows exactly what you want to do, and you know what they're telling you because we're all trained in the same system, whereas over there they don't have the technology that we have, and English is not their first language.
Right.
They don't have radar, is very sporadic over there, so they're just some technicalities of the flying is different. But I can tell you from being there, working in 85, 90 degree weather is quite nice compared to 40 below zero. You know, that goes a long way with me.
Like I told you, when I left trying to discover the Southwest, it's like, man, you roll out of your truck, you got your sandals on, your shorts.
Yeah.
And you come back here and like, man, it's June and it's snowing. God, I had a question right along those lines. Sort of along the flying lines, because you're filing IFR.
Yes.
And because but it doesn't mean a whole lot in Africa. There's no radar. Half time there aren't airways.
Right.
And
right.
Sometimes there are approaches.
Filing IFR over there is a lot like flying here. We're all assigned to contact the center frequency, and we're all monitoring that frequency. So we're somewhat controlling ourselves.
Right.
We hear a guy say, I'm 50 miles north of Brazzaville VOR. Well, then you reference that to where you are, and now you know.
Right.
And so, but you don't get a whole lot of traffic advisories from air traffic control over there.
It's more take responsibility for yourself and announce at the expected reporting points.
Right.
Did you come across, there's an Africa CTAF for all of Africa. I forgot what it is now. I always remember when I get over there again, but you'll hear jets on it. There's so little, you know, you lose radar contact with people a lot, especially in a smaller plane.
Okay, I know the frequency you're talking about. And we were flying into southern Sudan, South Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
And the frequency that they gave us for the strip that we were going into, we weren't getting any response from. And my co-pilot suggested maybe someone will be on that general frequency.
Right.
So I made a blind call to any aircraft on frequency, and I got a Ethiopian Airlines at flight level 350 saying, "What can I do for you?" And I said, "Well, we're heading into Yambio, and I don't seem to have the proper frequency." And he said, "Hold on just a minute." He must have reached into his flight bag, and he said, "Try this one." And it worked. It was awesome.
Well, see, that's what I found like. I mean, we're talking about how big Africa is, but I've been on that CTAF frequency ferrying airplanes, and everybody's working together.
Right.
I mean, it's like when you're in the Nome area or the Kotz area, you know, certain areas in Alaska, people will work with each other, but everybody knows each other.
Right.
And Africa is just like this big aviation community, whether you're in a 185 or a jet.
Right.
They're going to talk to you, and they're almost always going to help out.
That's right. Yeah, that, so, I was really, I cool. couldn't believe it. It was awesome.
So you were flying into the Sudan, too, which is obviously a problem area.
Yeah, the area we went into, there was no real conflict. There was, but when we went in there, there was conflicts that were occurring in the area.
Okay. Yeah, we got, we'd get briefings, the four flights that we knew were in the areas that might be bad. And you'd use similar thing, like if it's like, hey, it's the Sudan, the fighting's here, here, and here, you should be fine. Contact someone before you land. Similar type of thing, or...
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so people are keeping track of the security for you.
Right. The agencies we were working for had security personnel on the ground, and they would wave the flag if it was safe to land, and if it wasn't, then we didn't get the flag.
Okay.
And then then it was also included in the briefing before we even took off.
Okay.
And there was numerous times where security could not be maintained. So prior to us even departing, we were told, don't go.
Okay. So that was kind of taking, and again, and this, you see this in aviation a lot, most companies just want you to fly the plane. Like medevac, they always say, don't worry about what's wrong with the patient. Just
right.
do your flight, or you're just going to cause more problems.
Right.
So that's cool. That works out. Along the lines of a different type of flying in Africa, because there is kind of a... smaller plane, bush-type flying. Did you say it's not so much in the Congo, I don't think, and the areas that you were flying where the conflicts are? I think it's more in like Zambia, Tanzania, where the safaris are. But did you see any of that meet any people doing it?
I saw a lot of missionary flying.
Okay.
Where you have 206s, 182, and they're flying in either... people or supplies of some sort, and the pilots are there. They're getting paid, but they're more or less doing it as a part of service.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've talked to mission aviation guys here. They do interesting flying. There's no question, but it's usually a pretty heavy commitment. Definitely,
right.
People aren't doing it for the cash.
Right. It's more or less they're providing, they're giving something back.
Right. They're on a mission.
Right.
There is a I've talked to them, and they are definitely doing it. That's mainly why they're there. But there's definitely not an evangelical side so much, but they're
a missionary who happens to fly, not a pilot that happens to be doing missionary.
Right.
Work.
Yeah. Exactly. So that is usually part of the job description. Any recommendation for somebody who's looking for work over there?
Well, when I started talking earlier about going to South Africa and getting your South African license, that really, it's going to open up a lot of doors, because the validation process is almost equal to just doing the conversion itself.
Okay.
And with the South African ATP in hand, if you did not have, say, a Beach 1900 rating, but you had other experience on turboprop aircraft,
right?
You could attend their ground school, their flight training, and their company examiner could give you the check ride and then get the type rating placed onto your license.
So just easier.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
And another advantage I just thought of going over and getting, converting your licenses, you can start that networking process.
Right.
So you show up, you're there for 2 or 3 months doing your, it shouldn't even be that long, depending on what your experience level, but you're there
for a while. It would take you about a month.
Okay.
Yeah. And you're right, that is a big part of it, is that I've met a lot of people, I have a lot of contacts just from the whole flight training aspect of being down there.
Right.
And the flight training is taken quite seriously, and they do a good job of doing it. And while you're receiving the training, you're going to hear about, you know, just like any job anywhere, it's a lot of like how you get introduced.
Right.
So if you get introduced by someone that actually has something to do with you or has some experience with you versus just being a piece of paper that shows up on a chief pilot's desk,
it's going to help out.
Yeah. So, and I think I really came along just at one of those really lucky times, because I was able to introduce myself over the internet.
Right.
And next thing you know, I'm buying a ticket to South Africa and attending ground school.
You know, I think that's more common than you think, because almost every pilot I've interviewed about, you know, some of their first job or getting a job in Africa where it kind of came out of nowhere, sort of, they're all like, you know, I think this was a really unique, you know, circumstance, and it just fell in my lap. It's almost across the board. People are, rarely does someone say, yeah, I've worked really hard to get it. You get that too. And certainly if you work hard at a job, it seems like you will get it in the end, but a significant number. And so my suspicion is that the people who just falls in their lap, they've created a circumstance, sure, that allowed it to happen, whether they knew it, whether they're doing it deliberately or not.
Well, a lot of people told me that it was crazy that I was willing to just jump on an airplane and fly up to South Africa based on an email and a phone call.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, there was a little bit of risk-taking that I took on.
And there's the 10 years flying in Alaska before you went, which certainly helped get you the job.
Sure.
So there's... Yeah, so that always seems like a background. So we talked about this a little bit earlier, and I'm not to get into who you were contracting with, but we were talking about most humanitarian aid is contracted to commercial operations. But there are a few humanitarian aid groups that have their own planes, and I know of, when I was in the Congo, the Red Cross had a DC-3. I didn't think the UN had any of their own planes when I was in the Congo, but I recently found a website where the UN does have planes. They're flying in Afghanistan and Somalia, and I'm sure a lot of other places. Did you meet any of those pilots, or did you see that as an easy path to go, or really the way to do it is work for a company that contracts? And I know that's not a set-in-stone answer, but...
Well, my experience was that all the pilots that I came across were pilots like myself that worked for an agency, or not an agency, but worked for a carrier that had a contract to serve one of those organizations.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I don't, but when we would meet each other on the ramp, we wouldn't really get into who we were working for technically.
You'd work for who you were contracting
because with. Because we would share stories about who we were contracting for. And so, I don't know, I might have met him and I just didn't realize it.
Okay, so your identity, even though is whoever you're contracting with.
Right.
That's who your identity is. I'm flying for this organization, not right. I'm flying for this company.
Right.
But that may differ. We talked about SAF Air a little bit, and SAF Air guys tend to be pretty proud of being SAF Air. I've seen their planes around Africa, and
sure,
they'll usually tell you they're SAF Air. I mean, not in a bad way, but it's
right.
It's a good name
right.
to work for.
Right, and plus everyone knows because they're the only ones
it's that fly groups
in Africa.
Can I ask you a question? This is Matt again.
Yeah.
So you came with about 10 years of experience, so it's kind of a shoo-in, so you didn't have to go worry about, you know, the meeting the requirements for Africa flying too much. But what about somebody that's got less experience? Like, there's a lot of co-pilots from Europe and other areas, but not too many co-pilots from the U.S. So what would you have to expect to be a co-pilot?
In other words, how much flight time?
Yeah, like basically how many hours or experience, that kind of stuff, to be a co-pilot.
I think about 1,000 hours will assure you a job. But I've flown with guys that had 250
over there
in Africa, yeah, and so I don't think that there's a as far as the different agencies that you'll end up working for primarily focus on the pilot in command's qualifications. Mm-hmm. And so for someone that wants to break into the contract flying business as a co-pilot, I believe that once you have your commercial rating, you would be able to find yourself work. But different agencies have higher standards.
Right.
So, but usually what happens is you get hired on with one of these carriers that have these different contracts, and you get placed wherever you have the experience that they're looking
right.
for. And then as you gain experience, then you move on to the other contracts that require more experience.
Right. And these job postings, are they going to say minimum requirements 250 hours? How would you know what job postings to chase after if they have a high minimum requirement initially on the website, but they could actually be hiring 250 hours?
Probably networking.
Right, right. As far as how would you, the best way to go about finding a job in Africa would be to find out the names of the carriers in Africa.
Right.
Don't rely only on them posting a job on some job site.
They won't post half the time.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I... Yeah, and then... this is where everybody says it falls in their lap. If you're persistent, something will fall in your lap. In other words, if you're calling up... Personally, this is Aiden again. I wouldn't use the shotgun approach. Maybe to send out resumes, but then I'd pick 3 or 4 companies you really like,
uh-huh.
and then hit them up every 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And this is Sean, and as somebody who's hired pilots before and done recruiting and things like that, that the job of chief pilot is one where more often than not, you have so much going on and so many different irons in the fire that when it comes time to hire somebody, we'd all like to think that we go through the stack of resumes and find
the
perfect candidate. But more often than not, it's when we're looking, the first phone call that we get or the next resume that comes across the desk is oftentimes the one that gets hired.
Or the person that bugs you the most.
The one that you said, I've been hearing from this guy every month. I want him out of my hair. I just talked to a chief pilot yesterday who said the same thing. He said, this guy was a pain in the ass, but... you know, I hired him.
That's right.
I absolutely agree. And since we're on the subject of getting a job and getting it in Africa, Africa is a very cool place to go.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're looking for a job, you need to be willing to invest a little bit of money in getting this job. So the best thing you could do is just plan a trip to South Africa to go on a safari, go do whatever...
hitchhiking if you're low on funds.
Whatever.
Surfing.
and then stop in at all the different carriers saying hi. Because, like Sean was saying, a chief pilot is going to receive numerous resumes. And even after you go through and look at those resumes, who knows what the success rate is on getting that person to actually accept the position.
Right. Yeah. And that... I'm going to back up here a little more, and then we're going to wrap this up pretty quick. But you're talking about the organizations that are doing the contract, the UN World Food Program, Save the Children. But, you know, there's so many of them. They have a set of requirements. Like, we want the PIC to have X amount of experience. We want the SIC. Usually, they don't care. The SIC should have this amount of experience. The company doing the hiring. They can hire whoever they want. They just can't put them on that contract.
That's right.
And so if you won't be, so the UN wants the SIC to have 1,000 hours, the company might still hire you and they're going to put you on this milk run flying tourists for a year until you get that time.
Uh-huh.
And then they'll put you on that contract.
Okay.
That's how that should kind of play out.
Yeah.
Excellent. Anyone else have anything to add?
I actually had another question. So if you're over there working, how many years, is it a year you have to work there before the tax break, or how does that tax break work?
Oh, this is for the U.S. only. I don't know about other countries, but I don't, just fill in, people are listening. In the U.S., if you're outside the country for a certain number of days, you get a certain amount of your income is tax free.
You're exempt from the federal income tax if you're away from the U.S. 330 days in a year. And it's not 330 consecutive, it's just a total of 330.
Okay.
Which, in a sense, is pretty much consecutive, but you could come back, you know, for 2 weeks after being gone for 6 months.
Uh-huh.
But as long as in one calendar year you were gone for 330, then you're exempt from somewhere around 90,000.
That's what I've heard. It varies. They change it year to year. And I think one reason you get that 30-day exemption is, that's probably isn't the reason, it's a federal law, but for a pilot it makes sense. If it's a U.S. company, you have to come back for ground school.
Mm.
And so it gives you, you can come back to the U.S., do recurrent training, do ground school, get a medical,
mm-hmm.
and then go back over.
Right.
So that's the practical side of it. So John, we're going to wrap this up in a minute. You liked your time in Africa.
Loved it.
Back in Alaska. How do you like the cold weather?
I like being here, but I'm looking forward to returning to Africa someday.
I hear you. Anyone else?
Nothing here.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for sitting down.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.